on the board, I just drew something that was in my mind about our lesson today. It's not a lesson, but the period of time we're going to deal with today largely is from about 1800 to 1850, that period of time. In the Great Awakening, we're going to spend time on the Great Awakening, a little bit on Finney, and we will say, I always tell you what I'm going to tell you, then I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. Then I'm going to tell you what I did tell you. Okay, anyway, the issues that are prevalent in this first half of the 19th century are really quite remarkable. There are people that say these are the most important years that have ever been in Western Christianity, civilization. This is the most important time of, you know, that you can imagine. And so I got thinking about that, and going through the lesson, and I thought about all the things that are going on in these 50-year periods, which comes out of the Revolution. America is still, the United States is very much of a new nation, very much not on its feet yet. And so I thought about the pressures that are in the air to shape Christianity. And what I mean to shape Christianity by the culture, not shaped by what the Bible does with it, but what culture does to Christianity. Well, all these pressures, and it's probably more than I put up here that I could think of. These came to my mind real quickly. First of all, you have the pressure of Calvinism, which is not a new one. That's always been there. We got that anti-Calvinism pressure of Arminianism. We have this whole idea that's really, really new with America is this personal freedom. The idea that you can be what you want to be is how they say it today. And we have this whole idea now in government, we have it done by majority rule. It gets to the point where majority even is right. You know, what the majority votes for is right. That idea is a new experiment. And then we have the idea of national independence. You know, it's not related to England or in some ways we're not really being a threat to other countries, although there are threats of war with France and so forth, but not like if you were in Europe. And then we have a century and a half, we've had this whole idea that science now has come on with the answers that we have longed for so long, that we don't need a Bible anymore for certain answers. We can decide our origins by looking at science. So the science puts a tremendous pressure on the Christians to make adjustments to the Bible. Then we have the movement of common sense, where the believers sort of identify with that because we talk so much about, well, that's just common sense, and we find the unbelievers has common sense. So we somehow feel there's an affinity there with that, and we sort of, you know, don't know exactly what to do with that. And we have the whole idea of rationalism, which we talk about German rationalism, you know, sort of start with yourself and come to the knowledge of the truth. That's a pressure. And so all these things sort of squeezed in on the believers, and it is very difficult, as I've said before, if I think about layers, like Christian layer and, you know, professing Christian layers and, you know, marginal Christians, you know, put these in layers. It's very difficult to find who is who and assign, you know, responsibility or blame to various levels. So you almost look at this whole period of time of they're just Christians and they're just sort of balled together. Some are saved, some are not, and some are this and some are that. So these pressures are on all of these people. And then out of this comes, I think, two movements that will follow. One is going to be the liberal movement, which will be basically the degeneration of what comes out of this pressure. It comes the worst of everything. And then we have the conservatives that come out of it and salvage some of the best of things. And this is where we find last week we talked about a group of churches being established, schools were formed out of this movement that weren't there before. And the bottom one ends up being the liberal, the modern day, what we call denominational identification, the Methodists even, and the Presbyterians and so forth. They go out that way. So you have this pressure and it comes out with two streams that we will follow. Anyway, that's kind of the story. Not an easy section, I find, and then we'll talk about why it's not easy. And I'm not going to talk too much about Finney. The problem we have with this period of time, there's not a lot of information that's available. That's a surprise to me that there isn't more. And the reason there is not more is no one wrote. The reason there's not more is because it was so broad, it was so complex that you couldn't write it. And those that tried found it overwhelming and they gave up. So I didn't know that. So we end up having then a focus on Charles Finney. And since he can write about him, he, I think, takes on a bigger than life persona in the Great Awakenings, because he really doesn't come on the scene until about 1825, and we've had this Second Great Awakening already in full steam for 25, 35 years. So he shapes it at the end, and out of him, I'd say he is sort of exposes his views, and it gets a lot of acceptance, which are wrong, and it forms the bottom stream, what I'm talking about here. But he wasn't there in the beginning, so he sort of became an issue towards the end of this Great Awakening. And I think that's why sometimes we have so much about Finney and nothing about the rest, because that's really mostly about Finney is what we know. And I'll go through that with you. As I just said, I told you what I was going to tell you. Okay, we're going to skip that. I just put up these presidents because it's kind of fun to keep track of who's president, because the government is a real big issue at this point, and how what the government is providing for people and so forth. So we have Thomas Jefferson from after Adams. We have Thomas Jefferson. We have two M's, Madison and Monroe, and they're both named James, but you see Madison has an A and Monroe has an O. So that's how you keep track which is which. So Madison becomes Monroe. And then you have John Quincy Adams, with the son of John Adams. And then we have Andrew Jackson. We're going to talk about him a little bit tonight, and then Martin Van Buren, which that's beyond our scope for tonight. So just want you to show you the presidents. Okay, Charles Grandison Finley is a pivotal figure in Christianity. In terms of name recognition, he stands with the great ones: Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, John and Charles Wesley, Billy Sunday, Dwight Moody, and Billy Graham. But the reason for his fame is for his contribution to a disintegrating Calvinism. Not everybody would agree. Some would say that's a good thing. Charles Finney attracts the fascination of a train wreck. It is hard to take your eyes off of a man who did so much to change the Christian perspective, from whom a line of preachers was formed that shaped the American Christian aspect of America, which will be following the liberalism line down. Now, just an honest confession here, I, being a product of this style of evangelism, it is difficult to totally denounce that which was instrumental in my own conviction and rebirth. The question of Finney is often tied to Billy Graham. Some of you have asked about Billy Graham. Finds people defending one side or the other. This will likely end in a hotly argued standoff. It seems, as often as is the case, blanket statements just are not very helpful. So discussing Finney and revivalism is similar to carrying nitroglycerin. If the argument caused too much shaking, it'll blow up good friendships. So with all the theological questions, cool head must be prevailed. And I tell myself this as well. That is, we'll be challenged to look at the bare facts and be careful not to extrapolate beyond them and leave a lot of room for misinformation. Remember, we have a scant amount of information to work with. Now, it ought to go without saying for this Bible-believing group that when dealing with matters in which or by which souls are redeemed, the wind blows where it wishes, so is everyone who is born of the Spirit. Cannot explain it. We do not know where it comes from. We do not know where it's going. We also have John chapter 1, as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. It is often wise to refrain from brave speech or action, so we ought to be careful in our blanket judgments about the entire movement. When all is said and done, the wind still blows where it will, and the soul is still born of the will of God, not man, which goes a long way to explain any anomaly that we might find incongruous. Well, with that said, it is a fact that the fissure in the theological landscape came between the Great Awakenings, first and second. From the time of Luther and Calvin, mid-16th century, 1500s, to the end of Jonathan Edwards, died in 1758, 200 years approximately, the prevailing understanding was that the Lord God, creator of the universe, rules in sovereignty over all, saves men by the death of Christ, by an equally sovereign election. While there was a solid understanding of God's role in creation, these reformers entertained a foreign body in their theology that will fester and destroy their good understanding of the rule of the Lord God. Since infant baptism made unbelievers included in the church, their unity of understanding the truth was compromised. So the axiom is, when man inserts himself into God's authority, God will abandon man. Doesn't always happen overnight. A shifting away from divine sovereignty began even before the death of Edwards. Perhaps shifts in theology are slow processes, lest anyone remember the old. That's why it's got to go slow. The devil knows that. You know, generations forget. The new generation has no investment in the old, may not even recognize it, especially grandchildren. So it takes generations before orthodoxy is lost. Axiom. Children will hold orthodoxy less dear than their parents. The phenomenon makes possible dramatic changes in simply two generations. Now, there's always exceptions. Some of you are saved and your parents aren't saved. That happens too. But we have people whose parents are saved and children aren't saved. And that happens too. Now, it's interesting during these times, if going back to Jonathan Edwards and through this time, the divinity schools, I should say about the Second Awakening, can be seen as a continuous event from the first. And an unexpected factor in our day is that of the role of the divinity schools in the awakening. You know, we would like to think that the school should lead in this. In our age, we see that the schools lead away from it. In these days, the divinity schools, the presidents, were responsible for these revivals, these awakenings in their own schools. Really quite nice. So we have Timothy Dwight, grandson of Jonathan Edwards, Yale, 1795. We have Samuel Davies at Princeton, a convert from the Whitfield era. And others of Jonathan Edwards Jr. Became much more liberal than his dad was, and he was the president of Union College. That Union College went really liberal in not too many years. So for simplicity's sake, I'm going to do this again because I have to explain this every time I do this because I do it for convention, for ease. For simplicity's sake, I will continue to use the term Calvinism and Arminianism as describing two opposing views regarding the place of sovereignty. Who's got it, you know? Calvinism, and I say with the less baggage, as I will use it, is the original Calvin, not the kind made up for him by Beza, who followed him, who supposedly completed Calvinism, which is what we have today. So here Calvinism is that God is fully sovereign. Now, I can always stop and say, when I say Calvinism, that God is fully sovereign, I got to explain that every time. If I just say Calvinism, that's what I mean. On the other hand, we use the word Arminianism as representing the view that sovereignty is placed on man, not God. And I do this, of course, immediately that needs to be qualified since man does not run the universe, lest I last checked, he didn't. So man's sovereignty is limited then to his own soul or destiny. God runs the rest. I'm responsible for me. Now, of course, man's sovereignty over just his soul can be an impossible position to hold in the real world. No one can hold that as a partial sovereignty. So attractive is this position that the mind can easily dismiss any conflicts between divine and human sovereignty. I don't know how the mind does it. They do it all the time. Now, scanty information here about the Second Awakening. There are more generalizations and less solid data on the dynamics of American religion in this period than in any other in history. Foote says, we have no written account of the process of the revival in the lower part of the state, he says, as Mr. Foote. Murray on the other, and other authors are facing the same problem as they write in one volume book on the awakenings. With so much said about the awakenings, it appears the information is more about Finney than the actual movement. And to me, that makes it misleading. So picture, a drawing of the Great Awakening, and I'm just kind of like to look at it a little bit. It's kind of a fun picture to look at. People are sitting on logs. They've been cut down, and that becomes their benches. That's kind of tough to sit on that. We have a man standing with his horse, and if you would look further into the woods, you would see Winnebagos and tents set up and, you know, buggies and wagons and people that come to spend a week here. And then we have, I didn't get my marker out here, here's the little shed that is for the speaker stand. And if you look at it carefully, you might think that it's kind of a built-in megaphone with the roof shaped so that it deflects out the sound. These things were used without plugging in any electricity to make the sound a little better for the people. So anyway, here's a typical camp meeting in the woods, probably on ground that's not farmed, and because there's trees and either shade and so forth. And by the way, sometimes you'd have more than one of these going on at the same time in the same area. All right, so that's confusion by itself. Now, scope and records. The difference between first and second awakenings are hard to grasp. The second awakening was rather easy to record. We have histories because the limits of the geography and its duration was relatively short. Remember, the east coast of America and the southern portion of England, and we went into Wales, we went to Scotland, and these are recorded when they went, and people know about them, they wrote. So while Whitfield was the greatest, many others have biographies that were written about their work as well. However, in the Second Awakening, the story is different. It is widespread as far as the Midwest, which is now, I find out, Ohio. I used to think that Ohio was still in the east, but I guess the way you talk about Midwest is still Ohio. Then to the New England's, clear up into the upper New England, then clear down into the deep south, and over a period of 25 years or more, probably as much as 50, depending on when you want to cut it off. So Murray, our author, Ian Murray, I'm sourcing a lot, laments the lack of records for these revivals. They are known to have happened, but no histories have been preserved. There's been feeble attempts to write a history, but in every case, it has failed to capture the extent of the phenomenon. So to determine the center of it leads the modern reader into controversy where each place is claimed to be the center. That's how little we know about it. You know, you think it was in Ohio, no, it's in Virginia, or it's New York, you know, and no one knows because those were all could have been argued as the center. So in a sense, it was a broad spread revival that no one really recorded. Herman Humphrey, not to be confused with Hubert Humphrey, was well qualified for the task to do this history as a participant in the awakening. Has long believed that the revival period at the close of the last century and the beginning of the present furnishes ample material for a long and glorious chapter in the history of redemption, he thinks. But sadly, he gave up his first attempt at a volume as a task beyond my powers. 30 years later, at the age of 80, and still conscious of the unmet need, the old preacher, returned to the subject and issued the revival sketches and manual. Valuable though it is, the book provides, as he himself thought, acknowledged only a few selections from the time. And this was in 1859. Now, the next book on the subject came out in 1942. Far removed from the events. So the lack of literature from participants in the Second Great Awakening constitutes a major loss to the church. Well, with this warning, we should have a prayer and dismiss you. Well, I'm not going to do that. With this warning, we have a daunting task to explain the Second Great Awakening. It will be like explaining the whole elephant by its trunk or by its tail, you know, that story. Our descriptions or conclusions then may be subject to error. So take that for what it's worth. So we'll make some observations about the Second Awakening that we can make. Some of these things are obvious. Outside camp-type meetings, we just saw a picture of one or drawing of one, were common as crowds, often too large to be housed, although revivals may have started in the churches, moved to the outside. And remember, one thing that we don't have here is the Church of England looking over the shoulders of these preachers, you know, pull their defrocking them. They don't have any of that in America. We're into the freedom stuff here. The meetings were attended for mixed purposes. Social mixing certainly became a common one. Not everyone gathered there to find peace for the soul. More of this later. Sometimes for nefarious reasons. Their preaching was often done by gifted but uncredentialed men, which added a loose, ad hoc feeling to the gatherings. That there were no regulations is not strange to us, perhaps, but the days of ecclesiastical authority were quickly dying. Okay, now we talk about the beginning here. The beginning of the awakenings, there was this concern about the conviction of sin. All awakenings began with the return of a profound conviction of sin. I do not think that continues. So we're talking about the beginning, let's say 1800. The attributes of indifference or cold religious formality, many are suddenly brought to a hearing of the truth, a concern and distress so strong that it may be accompanied by temporary physical collapse, the phenomenon of hearers falling prostrate during a service or crying out in anguish was not uncommon at the onset of these revivals. And here we have some similarities with the first awakenings. A revival is, by its very nature, bound to be attended by emotional excitement. But the course of a revival, together with its purity and abiding fruit, is directly related to the manner in which such excitement is handled by its leaders. And we taught that with John Wesley. He thought it was a good thing. He thought that was how he could tell how God was blessing his ministry, if there were a lot of this kind of activities going on, because he saw that as an act of God and therefore being blessed. So some leaders didn't see it that way. But once the idea gains acceptance that the degree of the Spirit's work is to be measured by the strength of emotion, can you see where this is going? Or all the physical effects of any kind are proofs of God's action, then what is rightly called fanaticism is bound to follow. For those who embrace such beliefs will suppose that any check on emotion or physical phenomena is tantamount to opposing the Holy Spirit. And you don't want to oppose the Holy Spirit. Of the physical phenomenon attending the revivals, that of falling became the most common. People dropped as if shot dead. They might lie, unable to rise, conscious or unconscious, for an hour or for much longer. Some fell who had previously been skeptical of everything. Many, 150, 250, even 800, were recorded as falling during camp meetings. Now we got these camp disorders. The potential for disorder is increasing when the numbers assembling necessitated open-air gatherings and camp meetings. And you can imagine, while some of the degree of control was executed in a house and in a building, when thousands were assembled in makeshift villages and tents and wagons, well, I just showed you the Winnebagoes, difficulty of maintaining any kind of order was virtually insuperable. Got some words. So the reason that brought the crowds together, and I said before, were not necessarily spiritual ones. Remember, they didn't have internet. They didn't have Facebook. They didn't have telephones. So if they wanted to have any contact with the neighbors, they went to a camp meeting. The camp meeting's appeal was not just to the spirit of man hungering after righteousness, but to his gregarious nature. Seeking, in other words, surcease, relief from the loneliness and hardship of the frontier. So people went there for social reasons. And I didn't read it anywhere, but I know that there were hookups that happened in these places. People found each other. Maybe guys looking for a new wife. And this stuff happened there. So all this stuff is kind of like not all so clean and pretty as it would look on the surface. Others present at the camp meeting, such as sellers of liquor, and they would also imbibe, were there and with less innocent motives. So let's don't have these camp meetings just being so pure, all coming to be saved. Certainly there was that, but with that always comes this other stuff. So many of the popular leaders either did nothing to prevent access or acted as though the physical phenomenon, the falling exercise and other things, were miraculous. George Baxter speaks of attending these sacramental sessions in October. At each of these were supposed to be 4,000 or 5,000 people, and everything was conducted with strict priority. When the persons fell, those who were near took care of them, and everything continued quiet until worship was concluded. So you have an example of a very orderly meeting as well. So Bowles believes that the physical exercises, including the twisting, the jerks, and dancing, which have been cited widely to discredit the revival, probably were made up, were probably restricted to the comparatively few. While that may be true, the general camp meeting attempts to control were often abandoned. Since in a concourse of people, no one preacher could possibly be heard, many simultaneous meetings became the pattern, with spectators wandering in between, confused, careless, talking, and laughing. You just see the commotion. Well, in 1846, or now kind of towards the end of this time, Archibald Alexander, Princeton president, gave his final verdict on the subject. He's warning about this happening in his time, subject to which George Baxter had first written to him about in 1802, so we have the 40-year spread here. Alexander says, many facts which occurred at the close of the revival were of such a nature that judicious men were fully persuaded that there was much that was wrong in the manner of conducting the work, and that an erratic and enthusiastic spirit prevailed to a lamentable extent. It is not doubted, however, that the Spirit of God was really poured out and that many sincere converts were made, especially in the commencement of the revivals. Again, especially in the beginning. But too much indulgence was given to the heated imagination and too much stress laid on the bodily affections, which was intended to arouse the attention of a careless world. Thus, what was really a bodily infirmity was considered to be a supernatural means of awakening and convincing infidels and other irreligious persons. And the more these bodily affections were encouraged, the more they increased, until at length they assumed the appearance of a formidable nervous disease, gone mad, which was mostly contagious, manifestly contagious, as might be proved by the many well-attested facts. We had this in the First Awakening, you know, same kind of thing, and to explain what it is, and I won't go through that again. I just want to say it's very, very common, this extra stuff. Well, there's some dangers to this. This Archibald Alexander, some of the danger results from the religious excitements were, first of all, a spirit of error, which led many far astray. One of them were Presbyterians who had maintained a good character. Number two, a spirit of schism. A considerable number of subjects and their friends of the revival separated from the Presbyterian church, formed a new body. And by the way, the Church of Christ, the disciples of Christ come out of this, and they'd be the kind of the best of the group that came out of this period. Separated from the Presbyterian Church and formed a new body which preached and published a very loose and erroneous system of theology. And though a part of these schismatics, and through a part of these schismatics, when the excitement had subdued, returned again to the bosom of their church. Some of them went back, others continued to depart farther from the Orthodox system in which they had been educated, in which they had long professed and preached. Now we have the spirit of wild enthusiasm we've already talked about was enkindled under the influence of which at least three pastors of Presbyterian churches in Kentucky and some in Ohio went off and joined the Shakers. Now the Shakers is a real interesting group. Husbands and wives who had lived happily together were separated and the children given to be educated in this most enthusiastic society. And truth is that it should not be concealed that the general result of the great excitement was an almost total desolation of the Presbyterian church in Kentucky and part of Tennessee. So by 1846, Alexander's emphasis was occasioned by his belief that the terrible mistakes of the 1800s was being repeated as he wrote. Well, the good result. Thomas Cleveland of wherever wrote in 1834, "The work at first was no doubt a glorious work of God. Many within my knowledge came hopefully pious, most of whom continue until the present day, and many have fallen asleep in Jesus. The number of apostates were much fewer than I supposed." William Martin, another contemporary witness, concluded in 1843 that the great revival of religion, which took place in this country in the 1800s and continued for several years, was the most extraordinary in many respects that had been witnessed in modern times, and that notwithstanding the fanaticism which he saw, much good appears to have been done. A mixed bag again. So that's why we got to be very careful with generalities here. Now, historian, the Great Revival altered the course of Kentucky and Southern history. Evangelical Protestantism, especially its Baptist and Methodist varieties, was placed on such a foundation that never again was Protestant dominance threatened in the South. But hysteria was not the only chaff. There were other more permanent evils which belonged to the same period. The first of these evils was the sudden growth of new denominations, all claiming to represent true religion. You're surely not going to start one that's false. Instead of a few church bodies in 1800, there was, within a short period, what's been called a sea of sectarian rivalries. And I mentioned the Church of Christ, Disciples of Christ, Christian Church, all the same. We have Capital City Christian on Holdridge in town. We've got Christian Church downtown. There are a truly American born church without any European extraction. You can't go to Europe to see a Christian church unless there's been a missionary effort. They don't come from Europe. They came from the Great Awakening here, Second Great Awakening. Alexander Campbell is considered the forming founder of that, and they had the first convention in 1849 after they had been going for some time. Now, there are other groups. I looked up the Marshallites. I could not find anything about the Marshallites. When Google doesn't tell you something, it's really, really obscure. So I don't know what the Marshallites are. Maybe some of you know. Or the Cumberland Presbyterians is certainly being, what's it? Where's Cumberland? Kentucky? You guys know your East Coast either. Sabbath of Christ, I mentioned that already. They were close enough to the older denominations to be able to draw away members without departure from beliefs from historic Christianity being too apparent. Like the Disciples of Christ, they adult baptize. They don't baptize infants. Now, they've drifted away like most of them have been. They've been strong in ecumenism, you know, so that's kind of their character or their nature. And they have baptism of generations, which is sort of, you know, that's where it becomes difficult. All right. Others, such as the Mormons and the Shakers, made no claims for continuity, but simply saw themselves as custodians of the new truth miraculously received from heaven on tablets or whatever. This stage was being set in the West for a growing confusion. On a superficial view, this fragmentation may seem enough to discredit any belief in the revival as God-given. Some would say such belief has always appealed to the evidence that genuine work of the Spirit always unifies churches by a common faith in the Bible and by deepening of a Catholicity of spirit. And I don't think that's true. I mean, just because, I mean, it almost seems to me like, now that would be true if they were truly unified, but for unity's sake, we don't necessarily go that route. So I say, but the opposite can be shown as more likely. The idea of strength in unity really is a humanistic ideal. In fact, I just talked to somebody over the weekend at our funeral that we had, went to, and they said that the church fellowship they're involved in, they want the broader group, wants them to join them because they thought if they had more numbers in their group, like a conference, there'd be more strength. And I thought, no, don't do it. Stay small where you're really powerful. If you get watered down, you spread out. Okay, the War of Independence had not only established a new form of government for America, it had given rise to a whole ferment of independent thought, and talked about this last week or 2 weeks ago, last week, I guess it was, which could not readily be contained in the existing molds and channels. The war was successfully won against old order. One of the new orders was the equality of man. And we do get into some of these things that we have up there, common sense and rationalism and all that stuff. So as the argument goes, if men are naturally equal, then it seems to follow that the judgment of the common man would hold sway in the future. It was democracy that had begun to change the whole orientation of society. Remember, democracy was new in America. Together with the assertion of the right of private judgment, there came a new faith that majorities were always right. Now, we have lived long enough to know that's not true anymore. But can you see this as a new thing that would be attractive? Confidence was now put in the decision of the majority. We call it populism, rather than the judgment of history or the educated few. And now we've gone to see it on the other side, don't we, sometimes. So the Second Great Awakening broke into this historic process. To a major extent, it gave men the Bible as their guide instead of the goddess reason, whose reign had begun in France and been challenged in America. But the experience of Kentucky also demonstrated what could happen when men and women who are untaught in the Bible decided its meaning for themselves. But such people, while claiming the Bible as their only authority, could all too easily be carried away by things to which Scripture gives no sanction. And while they supposed they were following their own judgment, the fact may be that they were the victims of demagogues who knew how to manipulate the populist opinion. In addition to the fragmentation of church structures and contributing largely to it, now for the first time in America, all the new sects and the denominations had one thing in common. They rejected Calvinism, understood the gospel that had hitherto prevailed among evangelical Christians. The only sizable exception to the common understanding of Calvinism, the orthodoxy, was the Methodist, who began to arrive early in the last century. So now everybody is an Arminian. Not to the last person, but in terms of a movement is concerned. It's something that is very interesting. Another association was the Black American embracing Christian, Black Americans with slave race, embracing Christianity. And the distinct sound of the spirituals that were being sung in the churches then and still being sung in our churches today is very unique. The study has not been about politics in America, but in the post-revolution period, there was an intense struggle for the direction of what the country would take. Even here, staunch humanists disagreed. The division between the isolationist nation and the nation amongst the nations separated men like Adams and Jefferson from the early days. This continued throughout our investigation. America has not settled. Politics is always ugly, and where the human heart cannot conceal, and it's where the human heart cannot conceal its fallenness. This spirit is nicely written about in terms of outcomes, but it is no better than what we witness today's slugfest. Politics America took a defining direction in the presidency of Andrew Jackson. The age of the Jacksonian democracy, or the era of the, would you guess it, the common man. You see how this fits together. During this time, not Jackson's time, but during this time we're talking about, voting expanded to non-property owners and those who did not pay taxes. Interesting. Voting was by oral proclamation earlier, and the polling stations were open. You walk in, and you say who you voted for verbally, and everybody that opposed you would hear what you said, and you knew who your enemy was. So this was changed to a secret ballot. Many offices that were became elective and were no longer being appointed. Individual votes were counted, and elections were determined not solely by the Electoral College. I'm still not sure how all this works. I know how it works today, but I don't know how it worked then exactly. Interesting, here in Maryland, not in America, but this one state, Jewish restrictions to hold office and practice law were rescinded. Jackson won a popular vote, 56% in 1828. He was the man of, he was a man of and for his time. Remember, we said that the great thing out of the American Revolution was to release the individual from strings that bound him to rigid structures. That's the biggest thing we got out of the Revolution. Now, these structures, whether religious, that could be bad, social, economic, would release. This release would include all innovations, particularly scientific, industrial, medical, and now we add political. The release of the individual to innovate makes progress as perhaps most significant event out of the American Revolution. Individual freedom reigned. And that gets into the theology. So the Christian point is that the individual is responsible separately before his God creator and falls and stands by that relationship. But without a sound grip on Calvinistic theology, which was eroding at a rapid rate, the common sense of man drives man towards Arminianism. Freedom of religion also meant freedom from biblical theology. So the Revolution cuts the ties with the Church of England. The disestablishment idea. Disestablishment means that the church, in this case, the church and the state are separate, that the church is disestablished or the state is disestablished. These disestablishment ideas of the Baptists cut the church's ties with the government, and the Great Awakenings made religious experience personal. And that part we like. It is individual rather than salvation by a coveted group like baptized membership. They're now brought down to the individual. The ordination of leaders was not required for meetings of church properties, although ordination continued on. So the fact that each man is to think for himself is a good thing, and I say a biblical thing, biblical truth, is also a dangerous thing. Remember, again, the Puritans who thought heretics should be executed? In America, the government cannot establish state religion, yet some opposed the disestablishment of a religion, believing that a people stripped of Christian faith would be fatal to democracy. This conflict goes on. So as we enter the time of Finney, we have a generation or two of liberty, equality, fraternity, representing a rejection of established authority, which gave the individual the right to think for himself. What comes with this shift is that Enlightenment thinkers who opposed Christianity began to write and to influence people as Thomas Paine in The Rights of Man and had a logical attraction. At the same time, there was little religious spirit in America, says John Jay, American ambassador to London. All right, so if the social requirement did not not include attending church. No pressure on that. The freedom to attend, the freedom to attend, not appreciated. Freedom not to attend, appreciated. The religious spirit dies quickly, and with it, any discernment that may be necessary to avoid the theological icebergs. So in this and the closely followed period, we have the beginning of the unfettered offshoots of Christianity. And I just listed some of these for you. We have the Unitarians. They started earlier, but they actually got somewhat organized with Channing in 1825. The Millerites began forerunners of the Seventh-day Adventists in 1831. The Joseph Smith begins the Mormon Church in 1830. The Church of Science a little bit later, 1866. Jehovah's Witness a little bit later than that, 1879. And all of these that were the Christian type here were historicists and thus state setters. We have Jehovah's Witness, Seventh-day Adventists. I guess they have all done their turn at date setting and it's all been wrong. And they've been all post-millennial. Now, according to Gordon Wood, this period of the early republic is the time of greatest religious chaos and originality. Now, we have the climate for it. Greatest chaos, greatest originality. Another historian, Ward, says of this period, the most important single generation in the modern history, not merely of English religion, but of the whole Christian world. Murray, the Second Great Awakening has to be one of the most significant turning points in church history. 1835, a journal not known for exaggeration, believed that it had pleased God to make America the theater of the most glorious revivals that the world had ever witnessed. So that's the background. Now we have Charles Grandison Finney. Now, I have avoided Finney. Could avoid him some more. We have avoided Finney for the following reason. We need to allow the development of the Great Awakening without his overwhelming persona. He's not done anything to anything we've said so far. He's not been a factor. His impact on American evangelicalism is great, but it came later. So in order to keep him off the stage, we have established a Second Awakening without him, which is historically accurate. He does not make the scene until the third decade of the 19th century, let's say 1825. Much of what we have talked about happened without his involvement, so you can't blame everything on Finney. His success was no accident, by the way. The groundwork for his warped ideas had been laid before his arrival, as we will see. And we can say with confidence that Finney did not shape the Second Awakening, nor did the Awakening shape him. The two, time and man, joined, made his entrance, and continued to influence dramatic, was long lasting. So there was a point where, from then on, he was a factor. Perhaps as America became the nation of defeat to world dictators in the 20th century, it needed the I can do anything mentality. With an Arminian theology where man cannot escape his duty, he logically took charge of his morality and destiny. And this is something that I've never really had clearly in my mind, but once you determine Arminian theology, it will go to a work salvation because you start doing things. Okay? So he logically takes charge because he's not looking to God's sovereignty. He's looking to, it's his responsibility. And so now he's got to clean himself up. So I'll read this again. I could do anything. The American says, I can do anything. If needed, I can do anything, the American says, mentally with an American theology where man cannot escape his duty. He logically took charge of his morality and his destiny. Now, Calvinists have been too willing to sit around and let God do it. So there's a little tension there. So to me, this is an interesting point that we're not going to talk about tonight, but something to do sometime. Now quickly about Finney himself. Charles Finney was born in 1792 in the month of August, too bad, was an American Presbyterian minister and a leader of the Second Great Awakening in the United States, so to speak. He'd been called the father of modern revivalism. Finney was the best known as an innovative revivalist during the period of 1825 to 1835, a short period, actually 1825 to 1830, in upstate New York and Manhattan, although he saw revivals in Ohio and Kentucky and other places. So an opponent of old school Presbyterianism, that's Calvinism, an advocate of Christian perfectionism, which is Wesleyanism, and a religious writer, so he gets his stuff out. Born in Connecticut, last of nine children, son of a farmer, moved to New York State after the Revolutionary War. He never attended college, had natural leadership and musical skills, 6'3" tall, with piercing eyes, all of which gained him recognition in the community. He attended a Baptist church in Henderson, New York, falling under the preaching of an emotional revival-style preacher, probably where he picked up his Arminianism. He read the law, that is, studied the law, to become a lawyer, as an apprentice to become a lawyer. He attended a church pastored by George Gale, who saw 65 converts in 1819. By 1821, the whole region was stirred to a depth of 800 to 1,000 converts in one county. It was in October 1821, while working his legal skills, that he determined to settle his own eternal salvation or situation by studying all morning in this particular day, only to disappear into the woods at noon, staying there until he had settled his spiritual condition. In keeping with the awakening spirit of his day, his conversion was dramatic and full of emotion and wonder. Upon returning to his law office, he informed his client that he was no longer represent men on earth, but he would take up the advocacy of God. Now, in my preparation, I'm talking to you, me as me, I read the section out of his personally written testimony where Finney explains in detail his conversion to justification. Upon finishing the lengthy article on, by the way, you can look it up, thegospelcoalition.org, the account of Finney is good to show conversion as there is, good as there is. However, in retrospect, Jesus was part of the testimony, but he does not mention the death of Christ for him. Now, that's not recounted. Now, it could be credited as an expectation, you know, don't want to be too judgmental here, an assumption that everybody understands this, but he talks about Jesus and so forth. So it could be that, or it could be credited to his lack of basic understanding of the issue. So at the end of the article, the editor says of Finney, he went on to become the great revival evangelist of the Second Great Awakening, the president of Oberlin College, but bequeathed the evangelicalism a Pelagian theology, which means that man has really not fallen. And Pelagian doesn't mean that. And the Pelagian says that he's been damaged, but he's not fallen. All right, so he says evangelicalism got gifted this Pelagian theology mixed with a higher life perfectionism, which is still being in effect today, he says, modern writer. And then Michael Horton, who is no friend of Arminianism for sure, in an article entitled The Legacy of Charles Finney, Michael Horton traces how Finney rejected original sin, I just said that, a substitutionary atonement, the supernatural character of the new birth, the justification by grace alone, through faith alone. So Horton concludes that Finney is not only an enemy of evangelical Protestantism, but of historic Christianity of the broadest sort. That's a pretty strong statement. Finney's conversion was in 1821 at age 29. Before this time, he attended a Baptist church, often Arminian, but now a Presbyterian, where there was a great revival in process. Perhaps we can knit together his exposure through free will ideas prevalent then and in his returning to the Presbyterian church, and to anticipate his rejection of Calvinism. I don't know for sure that's the case or not, but that could fit. Immediately in his conversion, he begins to assist ministerial duties, assisting and receiving training under Gale as assistant teacher. The change in his thinking, as he writes later, in retrospect, occurred early, but not known for about 10 years. So even as he was ministering, his Arminian views and the views that I just read to you did not talk about and probably got fired. Not an unusual development when departing from an accepted theology. It takes time to settle the questions that rise out of the new position, so he likely matured somewhere in the 1830s and later wrote about it in his memoirs. But his dramatic departure from orthodoxy would only be possible if the fields of Christian theology had not already been weakened. A softening, making Finney's ideas acceptable when he takes up awakening preaching. So Finney in the days of Edwards would have had no hearing, nor would Whitfield give Finney a place in his awakenings. It took the softening beginning with John Wesley. So the Methodist train was catapulted into the new United States by Asbury onto the Arminian side, where man is sovereign over his spiritual life. On the Calvinism side, there was an erosion by Edwards, son, Timothy Dwight. I thought about doing some of this for you, but too tedious. But you know, there's a drift by everybody. Dwight had a genius for recognizing able proteges such as Lyman Beecher. We're going to talk about some of these people, Nathan Taylor and Leonard Bacon, all of whom would become major religious leaders and theological innovators in the antebellum decades just before the Civil War. So legacy. Finney is called the father of modern revivalism by some theologians, and he paved the way for mass evangelism efforts like Dwight Moody, Billy Sunday, Billy Graham, and so forth from Christianity Today. So we leave Finney here for a closer look at his new measures next week.